I want to remind you of the words of Isaiah 29, verse 13. It's a sobering indictment of hypocrisy. Isaiah 29, verse 13 says this, "The Lord indicted them," it says, "because this people draw near with their words and honor me with their lip service, but they remove their hearts far from me, and their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote." The whole idea of hypocrisy, saying one thing with the lips, with words, but yet, and the Bible calls it lip service there, but yet in their heart being far, far from the Lord. God has always hated that kind of hypocrisy, has always hated, of course, lip service type loyalty, lip service type love to Him, without sincere spirituality. And obviously, as God, He knows the heart. He knows exactly what's in our heart. As we go through the Gospel of Mark, we see clearly that the Pharisees were examples of that in the day of Jesus, examples of that problem, examples of lip service type love for God, lip service type loyalty to Him, but really no genuine spirituality in the heart. And they were antagonistic toward Jesus, and that antagonism of the Pharisees toward Jesus was plain for everyone to see. No matter how hard they might try to disguise the fact, their questions that they came up with from time to time were clear and deliberate efforts to try to catch the Lord somehow. Well, they kept failing to catch Him. So as we saw in our last time together, which we'll remember that, Mark chapter 3, we ended with verse 6. Since they were failing in their attempts to catch Him, we saw them turn and began to plot with the Herodians, it says in Mark 3, verse 6, plot with the Herodians how they might kill Him if we can't catch Him and trip Him up. Let's just take Him out. Let's kill Him. Amazing, just to remind you about that, amazing. Here were men, religious leaders, men who were outwardly devoted to honoring God, outwardly devoted to keeping the law of Moses, and yet at the same time deliberately planning to commit murder. So we can say that the presence of Jesus here was showing up some of the Pharisees for what they really were. They were men who served God with their lips, but their heart was far from Him. The great error of the Pharisees, I think, basically could be summarized this way. They really did have a wrong view of God. And secondly, and consequently to that, they had a wrong view, an inadequate view of sin. They could not see that knowing God meant knowing Him intimately, knowing Him in His infinite holiness, and reverencing Him for that, His heart-searching holiness. It involved one's own heart and its perversity and self-centeredness, knowing that about yourself. To know God, I must deal with that perversity that's in my own heart. And it's only when we see these two things do we recognize how much we need the grace of God. When we see His holiness, see Him the way He really is, and we see ourselves the way we really are, that's what brings us then to understand we need God's grace. Anyone that's ever sensed the real nature of God would not imagine that His favor is going to be earned somehow just by lip service, it's going to be earned by external rules and regulations, the way the Pharisees were going about it. If you really see God, you won't conclude that. If you really see your own sin, you won't conclude that either. And I think the Pharisees, their error was that. They really didn't understand God, and they really didn't understand their sin. I'm always love reading some of the insight that we find in the book of Isaiah. He declared that kind of righteousness in a familiar passage to us, Isaiah 64, verse 6. He declared that kind of righteousness, an external righteousness, lip service, the very best of it to be filthy rags, he said, stained rags. Isaiah is one who did have a good view of God. He did have a good understanding of his own frailty, his own sinfulness. And so we love that scene, don't we, in Isaiah chapter 6. That scene where he'd come to see all this in his own life. And he says in Isaiah 6, verse 5, when he saw the Lord, he looked at his own life and said, "I'm a man of unclean lips who needed pardon, a man who needed cleansing." Well, the Pharisees were not like that. They were not willing to look at their own hearts and see themselves the way God saw them. They really didn't understand God and His character the way God really wanted them to understand Him. And consequently, due to their spiritually hardened hearts, they could not rest until this Jesus, this thorn in the flesh for them, until He was removed. We're going to pick up in Mark chapter 3, verse 7, and look at just verses 7 through, I guess it would be 12 tonight. Mark 7, and Jesus withdrew to the sea with His disciples. Now, up to this point, we have basically found, I think it is four clashes that have taken place between the Pharisees, the lip service ones, and Jesus. Four clashes. The most bitter of those, I think, was the first one. That was the one where the opponents in their own hearts were saying some things, and Jesus recognized it. They were accusing Jesus of blasphemy. And then the fourth one, the last one, was the one we studied last time, when they began to scheme then how to destroy Him. Mark chapter 3, verse 6. And at the close of the first confrontation, we found Jesus then going to the seashore after that. It's not surprising then, after this fourth one, He's withdrawing to the seashore once again. That's what we see in verse 7. So it's against the background of the Pharisees' hostility toward Him that He's withdrawing from the crowd. We have to understand it in that context. He's just experienced this clash, this collision with the Pharisees. And so He withdraws to the sea with His disciples. If you look at Matthew's account of this, and that's Matthew chapter 12, verses 15 to 21, in his account of this, it says very clearly, and Matthew adds this thought, that Jesus withdrew because He knew of the plotting of His enemies. Mark doesn't bring that out, but Matthew does. So it is motivating Jesus to leave where He was and go to the seashore. The plotting of the Pharisees. He knew that the Pharisees were opposed to Him and plotting against Him. And He knew men's hearts well enough to realize that they would stop at nothing. They hated Him that much. They would stop at nothing to be rid of Him. So the withdrawal to the Sea of Galilee was an act of wisdom on His part, of prudence. It was prompted by His desire to avoid the collision that could happen next, the head-on collision with the Jewish leaders. It's really another evidence of God's sovereignty in all this, and the fact that Jesus marches to a different drum. It's not the drum of the Pharisees. Okay, He was His Father's Son. He was following this heavenly plan, a heavenly timetable in all this that's going on, a heavenly timetable. And the time for the big confrontation, the big collision, the final confrontation, was not now. And so He leaves them and withdraws to the seashore. An act of prudence. For the moment, He does that. He's not seeking a fight with the religious leaders before it was time. Now, the antagonism of the Pharisees, though, did not diminish Jesus' popularity with the masses. In fact, they seem to draw the common people to Jesus, even in larger numbers. I mean, you would think that maybe these collisions that are happening somehow are causing people maybe to take a second look at this, whether we should be following this man or not, and going to be ministered to him by not. And the interesting thing is, the more they opposed Him, it's almost as if the more the common people then flocked to Him. I couldn't help but think of two illustrations of that I've seen with my own eyes in the world in which we live. Obviously, I have had opportunities to minister in Italy, and I've had opportunities to minister in Russia recently. And through the years, I've seen this to be true, but I've definitely seen it in the last two times that I've gone. In Italy, there's a certain group of churches that have begun to oppose the work that we're doing there. They oppose the work of the ministry that I'm a part of, Aurora Ministries there, oppose any of the work of Pastor MacArthur, who goes there at times. And we've seen this increase to the point that in the last couple of times, the last conference where Pastor MacArthur was there, last October, a year ago this month, and then also this last time I was there in the summer, there have been evidence of, more than evidence, a proof that they are sending letters out to their churches telling their church leaders not to go to any more of these conferences where I and others are showing up. And the result of that is more of their church leaders are going, you know. So we're glad they did it, you know. Interesting. Same thing happened in Russia. A particular group of churches that are really make up the bulk of the Christian churches in Russia, there's been lately, in the last year or two, a growing opposition to the training that we're doing there in Russia. Because their pastors and their young men in their churches have been going to these training situations, this Bible Institute and the seminary that was started out of the Bible Institute, have been going to that now for several years, a few years. And their lives have been transformed, and they're growing in their understanding of theology, particularly in their understanding of God's sovereignty, even though that's not a drum that's being beat all the time there at all. It's just they're studying the Scripture. They're learning how to preach it, and they're delving into it. And they're coming out from that experience very well grounded in theology and very now trained and in preaching expositionally in their churches. And so this group of leadership of this large union have begun to take another look at this and have been sending out recently letters to their church leaders telling them, don't go for this training. And what it's done is it's made even more of them go. And it's interesting just how that works. You can't keep the truth down, I guess you could say. And so way back in Jesus' day, here are the religious leaders opposing him, and the common people are just flocking to him, it seems, even more and more. Now it says in that little phrase in verse 7, that his disciples were with him. We do know that by this time he had Simon, he had Andrew, James, John, and Matthew. We know of those five, that they had accepted the call to be Christ's disciples. We know from John chapter 1 that Philip and Nathanael had also been added to the group. We really don't know whether all these were in this group going to the seashore or not. All we do know for certain is that the complete 12 had not been appointed yet. We're going to see that in the next passage. Verse 7 and 8, let me read the rest of that. Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, from Jerusalem, from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, and the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great multitude heard of all that he was doing and came to him. Mark describes this crowd of the common people flocking to Jesus as a great multitude. In other words, it was one of an exceptional size that flocked to Jesus. Probably hard even for us to imagine how many people are coming from all these places to Jesus. The way it's worded here, and even subsequently, and you know, centuries later after Scripture was written, the way it was punctuated, the way it's worded, and later the way it's punctuated, makes it clear that Mark is thinking of actually two multitudes. There was the group from Galilee that followed Jesus. And then, besides Galilee, there's this other group, Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, etc. The Galilean crowd, that's districts that were near at hand. And so Mark says they were following Jesus, probably had more access to Jesus because they were closer. That's where he was. But the second multitude came from various remote districts, and it says they came to him. Some of these in the second group came from very remote areas. Some of them walked many, many miles to come to Jesus. Just a word about some of these. Judea, that's the southern area, where according to John 3, Jesus had earlier engaged in some public ministry. So many of the common people there knew about Jesus. Maybe even had been exposed to him because Jesus had ministered there in the south, in Judea. So many of them, as well as the watchful Pharisees who were from that region, they were drawn to Jesus' ministry from Judea. Jerusalem is a city in Judea. He mentions it second separately here. The city is being distinguished from the province, but it's actually in the region of Judea. Then he mentions a place called Idumea. That region is named only here in the New Testament. Just so you'll know, not you'll remember this, but it was an area south even of Judea, so further south. It had been invaded, it had been conquered by the Edomites. Way back in after the fall of Jerusalem in 587 BC, the Edomites had conquered this area. And they came from the east of the Dead Sea, and then they settled in this area south of Judea. Herod the Great was from that region. He was, and his family were Idumean. They eventually were forced by the Maccabeans to adopt Judaism as their faith or face death. And so they chose Judaism. And so the area had become largely Jewish over time. So they came. Beyond the Jordan, he says. That's east of the Jordan River. If you looked on a map, it would be to the east. Of course, I'm pointing the opposite way compared to where you're sitting. I should be doing this, but I can't think that way unless I turn around. This way, east of the Jordan River. It's called Perea, P-E-R-E-A, by Josephus, the historian. It has another name. For the most part, it's a very rugged, barren kind of desert and rocky area. But it had some scattered tracts of soil that were known for being very productive when it came to growing crops. It had inhabitants that were mixed, Jews and Gentiles, as some of these areas did, really. But there was a Jewish population there, and so some of them came. It mentions the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. That's an area known as Phoenicia. These were Phoenician cities. Sometimes Phoenicia would be called just the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. They would be the area was identified by these two cities. It was along the Mediterranean Sea. That was in the northwest part of Galilee. It was not really part of Palestine, but there were Jews in that area. Today, that's modern-day Lebanon, if I understand that correctly. It's interesting, though, that people are coming from all these areas. Mark is wanting to emphasize this for some reason, so that you'll at least get a feel for this. It is a great multitude from a large area now. People walking from everywhere, long distances now. Word has spread. Come see this Jesus. Interesting that no representatives of Samaria, though, are mentioned. And that's not totally surprising. The Samaritans remained aloof from the religious interests of the Jews. There was no love lost between the Jews and the Samaritans. They're not really mentioned. But all these other areas that had Jews in them, they had come. Possibly some Gentiles were there as well. All we know is a great multitude. Love to have seen it. I've said that before as we study through Mark. Certain scenes. I'd love to have seen this, what that looked like. You talk about a crusade. This was a crusade beyond all crusades. They heard of all that he was doing. In other words, the repeated reports of Jesus' miracles had filtered out to these areas, and so it's drawing vast crowds. And the ready gathering of all these vast crowds was facilitated by the Roman roads that were of that day. We know the network of roads was extended throughout the land, so that facilitated them coming. Verse 9. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, because of the multitude, in order that they might not crowd him. So Jesus gives some instruction here of how to deal, really, with the danger that's there. Jesus understood what this situation was. It's a dangerous type situation that's been created for him by this vast multitude that's now there following him at the seashore. So he says, you better get a boat ready. Mark is the only one who records this detail about the boat. He likes these kind of little tidbits to help you understand the scene. And the word is just a small boat. It's some kind of small, like a rowboat. If we tried to convey it in a one-word English term, we'd have to create a word like a boatlet. It was a boatlet, not a big boat, not a regular fishing vessel, just some kind of small boat. And so the disciples were asked to keep it available for him at any moment. Why? Because he may have to get in it and get back away from the crowd. It's been suggested that he may have stood in it to preach to the crowd. It doesn't say that here in this text. That's very possible. But the way the language is given to us in verse 9, it is the type of thing that they were to keep ready at any moment. So wherever he's going along the seashore, there someone is pulling this little boat along to make sure it's ready for any moment that he can get into it and get away from the crowd. It says in verse 9, very clearly, because of the multitude. It's because of this large crowd. Evidently, this was a confused and unorganized group. In fact, as we see the language here, evidently the scene that Mark is painting is one of great commotion. That because of the large numbers and because of the desperation on the part of the people, there was pushing, there was shoving. It says there in verse 9, in order that they might not crowd him. The size of the crowd and the eagerness of the people to get close to Jesus, to touch him,